This time on the show, the act of making the book is explanation enough.
Naked Baby Gru.
And do you read every book? How do you expect me to? All this and more on Comics Are Great. It's Comics Are Great, the visual storytelling show, recorded live every other Wednesday or so at the Ann Arbor District Library in lovely downtown Ann Arbor, Michigan, comics.aadl.org. And this is the show where we talk about making comics, writing comics, drawing comics, designing characters, building worlds, workflow, the lifestyle of the cartoonist, comics advocacy, all the stuff that surrounds this medium that drives us all mad. My name is Jersey Droz, cartoonist and teaching artist, and with me today is Dave Carter, returning to the show. Dave
hey,
Carter,
Jersey. Thank you.
Of a librarian at the University of Michigan Video Game Archive.
Yes. So amongst the things I do there is I select comics, and I'm this comic specialist for the university library.
And you've been on the show a bunch of times, and I'm always grateful to have you.
Oh, thank you.
But this may be somebody's first show, so I want to describe for the audience what you do. Because as I was thinking about it, I was like, and I may have said this before, but you're living the dream of almost every 12-year-old.
Including 12-year-old Dave. Let's write that out.
So what is it that you do? I mean, like a video game archive, what does that mean?
So I run the video game archive at the University Library. So we have, it's a room in the basement of the Duderstadt Center on North Campus where we've got 6,000 games and over 60 different gaming systems. And you can come in and use and play the games down in there. Wow. All in the service of supporting teaching and research at the University of Michigan.
Of course.
Of course.
So the only thing that we need to add, well, and you manage the comics collection.
And I manage the comics collection there.
And I got to say, I mean, I go there on a semi-regular basis just to read, mm-hmm. and the collection there is astonishingly good. I mean, you have really good taste as a selector.
Oh, golly, thank you.
Because, I mean, like, I can find, like, really out-of-the-way rare Eddie Campbell stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you could find, like any, you know, Eric Talbot or any, like, artist who, you know, did, like, a lot of important work 20 years ago, you can find that seminal work they did.
Because it's my formative years in comics. Oh, I mean, it's the advantage of you know, a library is that we can keep stuff around, whereas, you know, your comic stores are not necessarily going to keep that on the shelf for 20 years.
Well, and you guys library bind them.
Right.
So they're preserved against the elements.
Right? A little bit, yeah.
More so than just, like, you know, laminating a trade paperback cover, right?
We destroy the collectability all in the service of long-term preservation.
I love going to see my friend's books library bound. That is so, I don't know, there's something so satisfying about seeing, like, Dave Roman's Astronaut Academy with library binding. It makes me so happy.
It makes it like a permanent thing.
It does. It feels like now it's for the ages.
Right.
So the only thing that's missing from your job description is eating candy. Right? It's like Pop Rocks has to be part of the job description. And then
I will point out there's a candy dish in my office. That I feel on some semi-regular basis.
You have Laffy Taffy and Fruit by the Foot and all the things.
all that sugar stuff. Ah.
But anyway, thanks for coming back, because we're going to talk about Banned Books Week.
Indeed.
So I have a feeling this will be a little bit more of a serious episode than what we typically do on Comics Are Great.
Perhaps a little less family-friendly than typical?
Well, I mean, yes.
We're not going to be dropping F-bombs like Kevin Smith podcast, but, you know.
But we're going to be talking about heavy stuff.
Right.
So because we're going to be talking about censorship, we're going to be talking about why it's an issue, if it's an issue, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to debate it out. Because, like, I got a review of the show from Chris Schweitzer, Krugen Adventures. He said that, like, one of the things he loves about the Comics Are Great show is that I make a concerted effort to turn every episode into a philosophical debate. and that was, like, one of the nicest things I ever heard, because that is something that I take very seriously. It's like if we're going to talk about this, let's talk about it, like really look at it from every angle, mm-hmm. not just, like, come at it from our particular perspective.
Right. Because you and I could agree on this for hours.
Yeah. We really could. And this is something that I put in my notes, which we can get to in a second, is that, like, this, we both live in Ann Arbor, where there is a bit of a cultural you know, homogenization here in terms of political leanings, right?
One could put it that way.
I'm trying to find a delicate way to say it, but, you know, it's like we wear one of the colors, or, culturally speaking, on the spectrum of politics, right?
Right.
And so, as a result, like, when you say censorship, people are going to be in pretty much agreement here. But the whole thing is that across the country, there's different cultures, different subcultures, and different attitudes and morals. And so this thing is an issue nationally, even in the continent, right?
Right. And censorship is a spectrum of things. I mean, right. They call it Banned Books Week, but it's really meant to be not just about banning books, but about the entire conversation around different ways that people try to control access of others. Books in particular and media in general.
And the interesting angle for us and why we're bringing it to the Comics Are Great show, I mean, it's an important issue regardless, but there's an interesting wrinkle in this in that ALA put a special focus on graphic novels for this year's Banned Books Week.
Right, right.
That's very new. I mean, like, this is the first time, yeah?
I believe so. They're working in conjunction with the CBLDF on making this a, sort of a comics and graphic novels theme to this year's Banned Books
Week. The Comic Book Legal Defense Fund.
Correct.
Could you bring us up to speed on what that organization is and where it came from, just like in a minute? Is
oh,
it
golly.
Possible?
The Comic Book Legal Defense Fund is kind of like the ACLU for comics. They contribute to efforts for promoting free access to comics, and they provide legal defense for retailers and creators and others who have and libraries and whoever who have found themselves on the wrong end of the law when it comes to the comics that they want to produce and sell.
I remember reading a story. This would be like 10 years ago mm-hmm. of a comic store. In I think it was Texas, and they had adult comics, meaning like comics with adult themes and
right,
imagery,
right?
Behind the shelf, mm-hmm. out of reach of the general public. You had to ask for it to get it. Two plainclothes police people came in and asked for the comic. The retailer gave it to them. They bought it, and then the guy was taken to court for selling obscene materials.
Right,
right,
right. Or I think they might have sent. Did they send a kid in or something? I conflate all these different stories because there's various okay. permutations on this that happen
well,
throughout.
Well, in the article that I've seen, this is where I'm not doing my due diligence by actually digging up the story, but the way I remember it is that, and this is why the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund got involved, is that it was actually adults who bought it.
Right, right.
It was out of reach of young people. You had to be an adult to get it. But then in the courtroom, the prosecuting attorney's crowning argument was, well, that's all well and good, but as we all know, comics are for children.
Right, right.
And then the CBDLF had to get involved to defend this retailer because that's the kind of prejudices and weirdness that can happen in comics is in such a weird place, right? Because we've got all these superhero stories mm-hmm. that are trying to get more and more edgy and adult. So within the comics community, within like the direct market comic community, there's some kinds of stereotypes of they're not for kids anymore. They haven't been for 20 years.
Right, right.
But then outside of the comics community, you've got this whole thing about this is trivial kiddie stuff, right?
Right?
And so the people in the know are stuck in this weird battleground.
Yeah, so 20, 30 years ago, we're trying to say comics aren't just for kids anymore.
Right.
And now there's like, but comics can also be for kids, right? Because you're making that argument all the time on kids with Kids Read Comics and
right?
all that kind of stuff, right?
Right, right. but then there's also pockets of our continent where people just assume that if it's comics, it's for kids. And
right.
what do you mean you can tell stories about, you know, with like sexual or, nature explored or gender issues being explored? You can't do that in comics.
Kids might read this.
Kids might read this, right? So, yeah. Okay, so let's go back to, I wanted to start with, I went to an event yesterday that you organized mm-hmm. on the campus of the University of Michigan. Phoebe Glockner and Jim Ottaviani
mm-hmm.
did sort of an interview/talk about Phoebe's work and Banned Books Week. And one of the things that Phoebe said that I was like, yeah, you're preaching to the choir here. I agree 100%, and I don't think anybody in this room disagrees with you. She says, banning books is stupid. and I think that's... I think it painted, and I'm not accusing Phoebe of this, but I think it put into relief this notion that, and I'm guilty of this, this notion of, well, that's dumb. Only dumb people would do that, so we don't need to pay attention to those dumb people because we know that freedom of speech is super important and just have some responsibility and make sure that your kids get access to the right things. And if they do get access to the things you wish they didn't, that's a time for a discussion. That's a teachable moment, right? So, of course, banning books is stupid, but it happens. And there's parts of the country where people are saying, like, yeah, you know, like, this is a good thing. This is you're protecting me, and so I want to explore. I'm going to pitch at you, the librarian, some
right.
devil's advocate
all right.
kind of things.
I'm bring
gonna,
it on.
I'm going to come at it from I tried to put myself in the worldview of the person who says, you know, I need this feature of keeping it out of our public schools, keeping it away from our children, keeping it away from people who maybe are impressionable, right? And you know, get the wrong impression about life. So first point is comics is a visual medium, dude.
It is.
If you show a rape in a comic, you're putting a rape right in front of my face. And you could put that in a movie, it could be over in a second. In a comic, it's a static image.
That's right.
I can sit there and linger on it forever. And if I'm a kid and I shouldn't see that, you're giving me all the time in the world to spend with that thing. Dude, we need some kind of mechanism to protect children from these visceral visual images. Images are visceral. We understand them instantly.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay, I see your concern, Jersey. let's talk about this. So I mean, you're absolutely right that comics are a visual medium, and they're a different kind of visual medium from other sorts of media. Well, photographs. I mean, that's a similar sort of thing, where you can pause on it. They're not unique, but they're different from books and films, and exactly the way that you're describing. When you describe something in a book, you actually have to be reading that book to encounter
that's
that.
That's something Phoebe was saying, because like
you're not going to randomly open to a page in a novel and be shocked within half a second because of what you're seeing on that page,
right?
Whereas with a comic book, you might say, oh, look at these drawings. There's all these happy drawings of bunnies or whatever on the cover, and you open it up and the bunnies are doing sordid things on the inside, and you're like,
my child found Fritz the cat, and I am so angry about it. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So there's everything in this is context, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's what. Where did your child come across this thing? Who gave it to them? How did they find that? Were you letting your child run rampant alone throughout the entire library, and they wandered up to the adult section and they found this thing with pictures in it that you don't necessarily like? There's also the context of how did that book get there in the first place? Who made the decision to put this book in the library? And then there's the is some higher authority going to step in and make judgments, not knowing what was going on in that situation. So are you saying, when you're bringing up this thing, this my child saw this in a comic book, and I'm upset about it. What is the approach you're taking? Are you running to the mayor, and the city council, and saying, look at the trash that this library is promoting in our community?
Yeah.
I'm
saying, like, you guys are the bastion of you said yourself. You are protecting comics history and culture
mm-hmm.
through your collection.
Right.
You're not about lending as much as preserving.
Right.
Okay, well, why are you preserving this garbage that's just meant to damage my child's mind?
It's important. And, I can make that argument because the collection that I'm building at the University of Michigan, which is intended to be a research collection, mm-hmm. and we want to represent comics, everything that's been produced in comics. And if you leave out these kinds of comics, you're leaving out a part of comics history in there. Now, I will say that we do not have everything on the open shelves. We have a storage area where we put more sensitive materials in there, which people can request of you, but they're not going to just wander out and see that. Now, that's not to say that everything that's on the shelves is G-rated.
No,
not at all. So you've seen what we have out on the shelves. You probably would be shocked at some of the stuff that we have locked away down in storage.
Okay. Let me say that
somebody has made that decision of what's supposed to be out there, and looking at the community standards. In our case, the community is the University of Michigan. It's not necessarily the broader Ann Arbor community or the state of Michigan.
But I can go there.
But you can. But you're an adult, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we are creating a collection for adults to be in there. That's a completely different environment than what you're going to find in a public library. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So the responses and reactions, and unfortunately, we don't have one of the AADL librarians here with us, so you could put him or her on the spot instead of me. but we started talking a little bit before about how calls for censorship are oftentimes a reaction to a fear.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fear of that society is changing. And I don't like the way that society is going. But here's this one thing that I can see, and I can make an effort to try to control.
Yeah. Do you want to go into the parallel there? Because I think that was a fascinating parallel that you drew just before we started recording.
So for those of you who pay attention to the comics internets out there, there was a blog post from a week or so ago.
It was about a week ago.
From the wife of a well-known artist who was bemoaning the fact that when they go to comic conventions now, they're not making as much money as they used to, and was laying the blame on cosplayers. All these cosplayers are showing up. And again, it's a similar sort of reaction. And something is happening here. We're making less money. We don't know why, but we see this thing. Cosplayers are coming into the shows, so I'm going to make a correlation. Because human beings are excellent at making correlations and assuming causality for things that aren't necessarily there.
That was Frederick Wortham, right? The whole thing was correlation. Wow, all these kids are doing dangerous things. They all have comics. It must be the comics because they're everywhere. Well, after all kids were reading comics.
Right, exactly. So, there's millions of kids reading comics, and here's 65 kids
right.
who are doing bad things. And so clearly it's, and what's one thing all these kids have in common? They're reading comic books.
Yes.
So it's,
well, and that's the interesting thing that I think to be fair, and we're talking about a blog post by Denise Dorman, which we'll link to in the show notes, which you can read and come up to your own conclusions on. But one of the things that she does, I think, is right, is she says, I observe a phenomenon.
Right.
We are making less money at these shows. Question, hypothesis, did something change in the culture of these shows that changes the way, that we interact with it? Okay, there's your hypothesis. So now it's time to test it. And then when you this is where the thing gets problematic is when she starts saying, well, it's these cosplayers and their selfies that are part of the problem there. Well, how do you test that? Right. Did you test it?
Right.
It caused a lot of reaction online. But I think what you're also pointing out there that I think is really interesting is that, a lot of these decisions, these borderline knee-jerk reactions to things come out of a sense of fear.
Right. When you're reacting to someone who wants you to remove something from the library, for if it's a comic book or whatever, or they're reacting to your work and saying, how you're an artist, how can you possibly publish this filth that kids might read?
Yeah.
Is to recognize that there is a fear there. That person may not be in a place where they can discuss this rationally with you. And I think Phoebe had an excellent point when she was answering a question, which is that she is the worst person to defend her own work. Because she is so emotionally tied to what she did. And she's like, once I put it out there, I don't feel the need to defend it anymore.
Yeah, I wrote down her exact words because I thought this was so great. She said, the act of making the book is explanation enough.
Right.
Right.
Again, in her work, which you and I have both read, is some harrowing stuff going on there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all contextualized. It's not because she ran into an incident with the mayor of some town holding up her book saying it was a manual for pedophiles.
Wow.
In there. And if you actually read the book, it's the exact opposite. It is not encouraging that sort of behavior at all. But that behavior is depicted rather starkly within the pages of the book. And so if you were just to open it up and see, like, here's this one page out of this entire book that has some horrible, awful stuff that I would not necessarily want kids to be looking at either,
mm-hmm.
But you miss the entire context of where it happened in there.
Okay.
And I think it's very easy to do that with a comic book because, as you said, it's one of the great things about comics is that it's like this visual, input into the visual centers of your brain. But then that's the two-edged sword, right?
Yes. That
it's very easy to misconstrue an image if you're not seeing it within the larger context.
I want to dig at this just a little bit deeper from your perspective as a university librarian, as somebody whose job it is to preserve history.
Right, right.
You said there's stuff that's out of reach, and you said there's things that would probably shock me. So I'm guessing there's like possibly issues of Cherry.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, yep.
And things of that ilk.
Okay.
Now, argument. What possible research, intellectual, historical significance could straight up porn possibly have?
So let's say you're looking at the changing attitudes towards sex through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and you could look at mainstream, something like that. But you might also want to look at the underground culture of the time and what was being produced there, and see all the underground comics that were being sold in head shops and things like that. That people weren't necessarily saving around like that. And, you know, a research library is just the sort of place to store that stuff. Because today's trash is tomorrow's research interest.
Well, that's
that's like my life. It's the video games. It's the comic books. It's all that stuff that people were just, you know, throwing away or shoving in their back pocket and not caring about. Now it's 30 years later, and people are like, wow, that was a really interesting time in society. What was going on that was affecting that? How were people's art reflecting the times that they were living in?
So okay, well, I've got
what are people's attitudes towards sex?
Yeah, well, no, and what you're pointing at too is an acknowledgement that things do change.
Right.
And the good old days are precisely that, good old days. They can't come back necessarily.
Or
right?
weren't as good as we thought they were.
Well, that too. Yeah. That too, absolutely, right? It's like, but I think that part of the argument for censorship that I pick up on every once in a while is like, why can't it be like hazy picture of my childhood
right.
that I had in my head.
Why can't it be like I remember childhood being?
And yeah, really. And actually, I remember the early 80s in the town I lived in, like the movie theaters, they played X-rated movies at night. And like, you don't see that anymore.
No.
And like, even like the level of violence in a lot of like the pulpy films from like the late 70s, early 80s, like that's toned down a lot nowadays. And so like when people are like, oh, why can't it be like such and such? I'm like, really? Because like, there were bits of it that were really awful. Also, the fact that like it would be weird to work if you were a woman when we were little kids. Like, your mom works? Really? You know, like that was a weird thing. And like, we had to have like, you know, Claire Huxtable show us that, no, you could be a professional and have children. Yeah, we take that for granted now, right?
Right.
And we accept that that's a good thing. But, you know, it's weird how we can pick and choose about that kind of stuff. Okay, I got a more ostensibly reasonable argument.
All right.
So I like the Karl Barks.
Sure.
He's a master storyteller. Donald Duck, Scrooge McDuck, DuckTales, right? All that stuff. Terrific. Went back and read some of those old comics. There are some depictions of minorities in those books that made me feel a little squeamish. And I'm looking at this and going, this is Donald Duck. This is for kids.
And it was for kids back in the day. And and when he was writing that, there were not parents out there, you know, saying that this is horrible for my kids to read, right?
Right.
But now, you know, the people are going to be saying, you know, here's, like you said, there's some things that were in there that were acceptable 50 years ago that we would not consider acceptable for children to be looking at now.
Right. So, like, okay, what's the line on this? Is it a children's book? Is it an adult's book?
Crap, I don't know. and that's the difficulty. That's the difficulty with being a censor, right?
Right.
Is that you want to have these guidelines that say, you know, if it's on this side, it's okay, and if it's on this side, it's not okay. And the real world is a lot fuzzier and more blurry than that, and depends on context. You're going to hear me saying that a lot here this afternoon. Context. Are you just handing this to a kid and letting them go off to read it, or are you reading it with your kid, and then that brings up an explanation of how you know, it's not acceptable these days to present you know, certain people in such a light, but it was considered acceptable, even though it really should not have been back in the day. And you can open a dialogue, you know, with the kid, and use this comic, you know, as an entertaining comic as a way to open up a dialogue about the changing attitudes towards races or sexes or people of different orientations or whatever, different cultures, and the way that they're being presented. And why you might not want to do that sort of thing. So it's
oh, you want me to raise my kid now too?
I want you to raise your children, Jersey, all of them.
Oh, for crying out loud. All of them. They're all across the country, folks. But okay, you anticipated my next question. I don't remember. Did you say at the top of the show how many comics are in the collection at the Duderstadt?
I don't know.
Okay. Bigger than a bread box? More than 1,000?
Oh, it's several thousand.
Several thousand.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I'm going to be that parent again.
All right.
Have you read all of them?
No, I've not.
How do you expect me to?
I do not.
But I got to sit there and play watchdog for my kid to make sure that they don't read something I don't want them to read, right?
That's right.
You provide no respite, no relief from being a parent, Dave. That I think that's the takeaway we get today.
Let me point out that neither of us have children.
No, it's easy for us, right?
Well, let me tell you an anecdote from my childhood. When I was 10, 11, 12 years old, I was a heavy reader of Mad Magazine. Mm-hmm. Mad, Cracked, all those sorts of things.
Plop.
I don't think I got to Plop in those days. But at some point, my mother learned from another parent about some of the content of Mad Magazine, mm-hmm. And most of which was going way over my head. that I was not reading it for that content. I liked the funny Superman parody sorts mm-hmm. of things, and there are the Sergio Origoni stuff and all that. But they would make references to sex and other sorts of things within there, and so my mother had not been closely monitoring what I was reading. I was a bright, precocious child who read everything I could get my hands on, you know, Peanuts comics and novels and Mad Magazine was one of the things that I read. But my mother decided that I should probably not be reading these things at my level of development at that time. So we had this talk.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, we are taking these away from you. We will pay you for these, you know, because you spent your money on these things.
Oh, wow.
So she basically refunded the money that I had spent on these, but we would like you to not purchase and read these anymore. And so what did she not do? She did not, call out the pitchforks out there. But she said that she had talked to, because my friends had read that, and she talked to my, you know, she talked to my friends' parents about this as well to make sure that they knew what sort of content was in there. So the next two or three years, I was not allowed to buy any Mad. But she didn't say you can't read any comics. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's what got me into buying Superman comics, was that I really liked comics, but I couldn't buy this Mad magazine anymore. But look, here's Superman on the spinner rack, so let me pull that off. And then that sent me way down a road to this day I'm still traveling on. But, you know, she didn't go to the newsstands and want it banned from all this stuff. So my mother made a decision as a parent for what she thought that I was able to read at that time and what I should do. Now, they did not warp me. I like to think I'm a productive member of society.
Oh, you're a librarian, for crying out loud.
But I'm a librarian for comic books and video games.
Well,
so some
yes.
people might,
but might but you get to say you're a librarian, which that it evokes the picture, and people says like, oh, he's a grown-up.
Right, right. Yeah. So my mother played the proper parental role. Mm-hmm. In that thing, did not try to censor that thing from existing.
You're not reading this trash, right? Like make inflict shame,
right?
Inflict like judgment.
Yeah, did not do that, and didn't cast a poor light on an entire medium based on one instance of something.
Yeah, well, and also, I mean, to step away from the devil's advocate box for a second, another thing that I think a lot of people tend to forget is that children are exposed to this stuff pretty regularly, regardless of how much you intervene. Like, when I think about playground activities, and I'm not talking about sex happening on the playground, but I'm talking about sex jokes mm-hmm. happen on the playground, bullying happens on the playground, all sorts of, like, because you're in this, at least in public schools, actually, now that I think about it, I was next door to a Catholic school, and those kids were wild. those kids are exposed to stuff from different arenas, and they bring it into this melting pot called the playground. And I remember I was teaching a class once, and a kid said, he's like, well, I'm not going to say that word that I'm thinking of in front of you because you're a grown-up. And I said, I know you know what that word is because you go to school.
Right, yeah.
And kids say all sorts of terrible things in the playground.
Yeah, the kids pretend that the parents don't know what they're saying.
Yes.
And the parents, so the parents try to hide language from the kids, and kids try to hide the language from the parents, and they're both swearing like sailors.
And I hung a lampshade on it, and I said, like, look, you know and I know, but the unspoken contract is that we pretend that neither of us know. So don't use that language in my classroom. Behave like a good kid. But I know what's going on. That's fine. I think like a lot of people, they tend to think that like the childhood is this glorious, innocent time where you're this blank sheet of paper. And things can have a profound impact on you in the wrong way, right? If I had a little girl, I'd want to protect her from everything evil in the entire world, right? I would become totally Papa Bear about it. But you can't.
Right.
Because if they're going to be exposed to the public, which they should because we're social creatures, then that's going to happen. I don't know if that's too – is that nihilistic? I don't know.
Gosh, this got depressing.
But okay, so I'm going to go devil's advocate the other way now. And then we're going to go into what we can do about all this stuff, all right?
All right.
Going back to living in Ann Arbor, and, you know, Phoebe says, like, banning books is stupid. And I go, yeah, it sure is stupid. These people who demand that books get banned, I've seen some of their pictures, and they got weird hairstyles. They're dressed up in, like, 1980s powder blue suits sometimes. Sometimes they're, like, really kooky characters who represent the moral majority or whatever. They're just crazies. Do we really need to pay that? Don't feed the trolls, Dave. Don't feed the trolls. Don't give them any ammunition, right? Just ignore them. They'll go away.
That is certainly one avenue that can be taken. And in many instances, it's the proper response to it is to not so, sometimes people are clearly they want attention. Mm-hmm. And this is one way that they can get attention put on themselves. And as you say, when you feed that attention, it just causes them to go on and on and on. But that's not the only driver, I think. It's a very complicated issue. And there are many different reasons why somebody might be having the reaction that comes out, this book should not be in the school or the library or available for sale or whatever approach you're taking on that. And it's hard to dig into why is whatever they're feeling inside coming out in this such a manner. And unfortunately, we can't all be psychiatrists, right?
Well, but I like what you're pointing to. You're pointing to empathy. Yeah. You're saying, like, I'm trying to understand your worldview here, bro, while you're saying this stuff.
Yeah. And I think an empath, trying to have a little empathy with that in there, saying, yes, I can understand why you would find this disturbing for a child, but children are not the intended audience for this. That is why we put it in the adult section of the library, or that is why we've wrapped it in plastic and put it up on on the top shelf in the store, where children shouldn't be able to get access to it. So I think there's a little bit of responsibility on behalf of the library and on behalf of the store or whoever to make a judgment on who is the appropriate audience for this, and I don't want to call this censorship. It's selection. if you get a room full of librarians together, there are things that we do not buy for the library because it does not fit in with the collection. We have a collection policy for this library. We have developed.
Is that policy public?
It should be. If you have a good library, it should be public and available for people to look at. And so there may be a broad collection policy for the library, and there may be specific policies for particular types of materials. So you might have a collection that specifically spells out movies, for example. What sort of movies are we going to have? Like, we are not going to have triple X rated films in there.
We're not going to have snuff movies.
Snuff movies or things like that. So we will only have G, PG, PG-13, and R rated movies. And minors will need permission from their parents in order to check out an R-rated movie. That's a very common policy but that might not be the case. I don't know what ADL's policy is
asking you to speak for ADL.
No. But I've seen that sort of policy at different libraries. And it's going to vary from library to library and depending on community and community.
Well, I mean, that's the glory of living in a democracy where your tax dollars fund your library. You get a say in this stuff. Go to board meetings and raise your voice there.
Right. And vote in the library board elections or school board if the school district controls library in your community, and let your community standards be known by the library.
Yeah, and they have regular board meetings to listen to you on these issues,
and they might not agree with you,
Sure, they're not obliged to do anything about it,
right? And let us recall that there is something called a First Amendment in this country. Which says that's
the one about guns, right?
It's the one that comes before the one about guns.
Oh,
which talks about free speech and freedom of the press, and that the government will not be stepping in and saying what can and can't be published.
I want to get to that because you linked this morning to a couple of articles that were talking about the rating system that was enforced for or was attempted at DC Comics, and it caused like a big, you know, debate.
Right.
And what they were trying to do was they were trying to create basically like, I guess, create like a new kind of comics code where it's like they were going to be some. Right.
Well, we should probably back up and talk about the comics code
because
it doesn't exist today.
Right.
And kids these days, young adults, kind of grew up in a world without a comics code.
That's weird.
Isn't it? So one of the results of Frederick Wortham's Seduction of the Innocent and his testimony in front of Congress, which was basically blaming comic books for all the ills for juvenile delinquency and all the ills thereof, was that in order to avoid government censorship, several publishers banded together and created the Comics Code Authority. This was 1954.
The comics industry said, "Look, we'll self-regulate,
right,
just to keep you guys out of our hair."
Right. Yep. And so they came up with a exhaustive list of what cannot be depicted in comic.
You want to show the comic?
Yes. Yeah. So this is a 1997 mini comic that Matt Feazell produced. It's called Comics Code Illustrated. They held it up there into the thing, he got a bunch of his cartoonist buddies to. Each I better show a page that can be shown.
Can be
shown here.
Yeah, the Sergio Aragon is one we just have to cover of it up.
So here's.
So I'll read it. Restraint in the use of the word crime in titles or subtitles shall be exercised. And then it has an illustrated cover of a comic called Crime and Crime Again. Criminally, criminal fun in this issue. Criminals commit incriminating criminal acts of crime. Crime, crime, and more crime. So this comic is so much fun. It's a crime.
So you got a bunch of cartoons to illustrate, you know, examples of the sorts of things that they were trying to ban.
Yes.
Usually rather humorously in there. The one that we won't show was a one of nudity should not be depicted, and Sergio Aragonés drew this cartoon of Baby Gru, a naked Baby Gru.
Yes.
It's the most adorable thing you've ever seen.
It's the most adorable naughty thing you've ever seen in your life. Yes.
It's like who could take offense to that depiction there. But it was like thing after thing after thing of the sorts of stuff that you were not allowed to depict in there, which was a lot of it had to do with crime and criminals and that criminals should always be caught in the end, and it should not be a manual for how to commit a crime.
You know, authority should be shown with respect in the story.
Right. And there were things about language and sex and nudity, and there were a couple of admirable things in there as well, as in, you know, culture shouldn't. You know, different minority cultures should not be shown in a negative light was, you know, something that was in the Comics Code. Mm-hmm. And it was revised in 1971 and again in 87 perhaps.
That was around the time when DC did this new change where they wanted to put a rating system.
Right. And most of the major comics publishers signed on to the Comics Code at the time. Famously, Dell Comics did not. The publishers of Disney stuff and Warner Brothers stuff and everything.
Is it because that their content was self-evident?
That was basically what they said, which is that our internal standards are stricter than this anyway, and we are not going to pay money to be part of this thing and submit our comics to that.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that they enforced the Comics Code was most of the newsstand distributors refused to distribute comics that didn't have the Comics Code seal on them.
Right.
And they and William Gaines said that the other publishers drove him out of business. That a lot of the things that were written into there were specifically aimed at the best-selling EC titles.
EC title comics were played front and center. Witness for the prosecution or for the defense.
Right. They're horror comics and they're crime comics and all that. And they had, you know, thrilling crime stories or that sort of thing.
And here's another example of how censorship can be a dangerous thing. Is that Stephen King, arguably one of the most popular authors of the late 20th century, right? Mm-hmm. He did a movie called Creepshow, right?
Right.
Oh, we're getting some weird feedback, Matt. Oh, interesting. It's like I'm picking up like room noise as well as my mic noise. Anyway, we'll just keep going.
All right. I got to take my headphones off. That is weird.
We're getting some overdrive, so you can probably lean back from the mic a little bit. Don't be quite so close.
All right.
But Yeah, that is weird. It's like it's as if my mic's not okay. If I get tight on the mic, I still get it. Anyway, sorry, folks. Sorry about the audio snafu. Matt will sort it out. But he does what we call Creepshow. And the audio problem's fixed.
the old Nina.
Matt, we just got a new nickname for you. He's back there like a one-man band, folks. He's got like cymbals and drums and trumpets and everything. And so if he makes one wrong move, like the whole thing comes apart. Anyway, so this movie Creepshow comes out, and it basically is a huge love note to EC Comics. And he even said like his interest in becoming an author began with the EC Comics.
Right.
Had those comics not been around when he was there to read them, right?
We might not have the Stephen King that we have today.
That's right. I mean, however you feel about him as an author, right? I mean, he made a lot of people happy, right? So anyway.
Or scared the crap out of a lot of people.
That too. For some, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
this whole thing, like, and I'll link to the articles that you sent me in the show notes, and this will be at comicsgreat.com/CAG105. You should read them. There's a long interview with Alan Moore, and he said this, and this is what I think was one of the most interesting things. It goes back to something Phoebe said about the act of making the book is explanation enough. This is an excerpt from the article about how Alan Moore feels about censorship and enforcing internal guidelines on content. He says, so to me, even though I might object to the warmongering aspects of a book like G.I. Joe, for example, and I love G.I. Joe, but he's right, you know,
yeah.
he's like, but my response to that will not be to try and get a campaign to get G.I. Joe taken off the shelves or put on a higher shelf or put in a plastic bag or given a rating on the cover. My response will be to contribute to something like real war stories, which make me feel that I'm redressing the balance in a positive way, right, rather than trampling over the opposition through sheer brute force. There's right. Alan Moore for you.
So that's kind of the response to art that you don't like is to make art that you do like, or to support art that you do like.
But then again, you're asking me to do stuff, Dave.
I am. I'm asking you to think about this.
Yeah.
I'm asking you to think about it critically.
Yeah.
And I'm asking you to vote with your votes, vote with your dollars, mm-hmm. but to not silence other people.
Is censorship the antithesis of being an engaged and active participant? I mean,
I'm not sure. That's an interesting question. I don't. Because it certainly is a form of engagement.
Sure, but it's right. This kind of engagement. It's covering my ears, saying no.
And it's having a reaction to something.
Mm-hmm.
I should point out, folks, that I am speaking as myself and not a representative
of neither the Ann Arbor District Library nor the University of Michigan.
My opinions are my own.
Oh, that's true. You got to do that. See, that's where I'm in a privileged place as a cartoonist.
It's
who
like
works
you
for
work for yourself.
I can say whatever I want. I still sweat it a lot, but we can bypass that. But okay,
so I'm sorry. What was the question?
I just kind of threw out this dumb like trumped up. Is censorship the antithesis of engagement?
In some ways it is. I think the reaction to the call for censorship is perhaps even more important. It can be a call for engagement. Yeah. Perhaps that person is going to put their hands over their ears and la 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 la. I don't want to
go. at the thing yesterday with Jim and Phoebe. Somebody asked a really interesting question that I jotted down. I'm like, that's going on the Comics Are Great show. They asked, you know, how do we reach out to people who react poorly to or unexpectedly aggressively towards a work? How do we reach out to, you know, start a dialogue with these people? Because if they are just covering their ears and saying, no, nobody should see this, it's trash. How do you?
There are some people you can't talk to.
Sure, no,
but I think we should make the effort if we want to promote comics as a serious art form and as a serious medium that is capable of great profundity and great inanity and all the spectrum in between there, like all art forms are.
Yeah.
That we should want to try to make the effort to engage when people are critical of the medium that we love, and it has to come from a place of empathy. That trying to shout down someone who's trying to shout you down just ends up with a bunch of people shouting.
It's funny that right after that talk, I was walking across the Diag, and I'm going back to my car, and I see a gal walking along, and she's talking to her iPhone, where like the pizza box style,
yeah,
which is like for some people, strike one. but she's talking very loudly, and she says like, the difficulty, this is like a paraphrasing, but it was essentially, the difficulty in spreading Christianity is you can't get through to those people who live that lifestyle. And I was like, yeah, you're shouting that out loud. Freedom of speech, all right? But like, it's like, it dawned on me as I was walking away, I was like, wow, that's the trick, is how to evangelize without being an evangelist.
Without being, what's the word I want? Well, there's the word I want. I can't use
it. Or like dogmatic, or right. or too brutish about it. Like, well, it's self-evident, you idiot.
Right.
How do you not get what I get? The writing's clearly on the wall. It's in big red letters. How come you're so dumb, dummy, that you don't see what's written there? Right. You keep in mind this sense of empathy, like understanding where they're coming from, what their worldview is. Even if they are a little kooky, yeah, right? Yeah. We're all a little kooky.
So it's gosh, we got to make an effort on this stuff. Yeah. That's one of the hard things I think about if you really consider Banned Books Week and what it means, is that it's not just an opportunity to say, oh, people who ban books are stupid. It's actually a call for us to be engaged in examining our art form of choice, as it were, whether it be books or movies or comic books or whatever, and be willing to engage other people.
Well, one of the things Jim Ottaviani suggested upon that question is he said that he'll take pictures of himself reading banned books and write a little bit about the value that book brought to his life. And that leads me to the event tomorrow. There's an event tomorrow on the campus of Ann Arbor, Michigan.
There is, yes.
Or the University of Michigan, I should say. So what do we got going on?
So we're doing so every year for Banned Books Week, in the past, the University Library has sponsored a readout on the Diag, mm-hmm. where people will come to a microphone and read passages from their favorite banned books. And with this year's theme being comics and graphic novels, we realized that there was a slight challenge in doing that.
Sure, yeah.
In that we're talking about a visual medium. So we're having a comics read-in on the Diag tomorrow from noon to one. We are inviting people to come to the steps of the Hatcher Graduate Library with a comic book and be seen in public reading that comic book. Now, this does not have to be a banned comic or a salacious comic or anything.
Which we're going to get to in a second, but it could be.
It could be if you wanted to. And we're going to have a pop-up library there on the steps with some banned comics from the collection of the University of Michigan Library that you can check out.
Flaunting your sin.
That's right. That is right.
So, in other words, the University of Michigan's campus is Sodom and Gomorrah. It's just debauchery.
Well, you would be surprised at some of the stuff that has been challenged and banned. We can probably get to that.
Can we do that?
But tomorrow, yeah. If you're listening to this live, it's tomorrow. If you're listening to it
long after that,
sorry. So that's Thursday, September 24th, noon to 1. Come and support comics by reading comics and a group of people on the Diag, and we'll talk about comics.
I'll put, they say that the key to marketing is always make it about the person, right. Like what value they'll get out of it. Here's the value you can get out of it. You're a comics person. You're alone. You're special. You read comics. Where are all the other comics people? Here's a gathering. You're going to meet the other comics people at this thing. Make a friend. Yeah. Make a friend who loves comics.
That's so right. There you go. and so I'm hoping for a big turnout, but it might just be me and three other people out there reading comics. But darn it, we're going to be there.
I'll be there.
All right.
So.
All right. So there's.
Oh, wait. Noon to one. Noon to one. I can do that.
Excellent.
So I got a thing at one, but I can be there for part of it. So, all right. Awesome. So I'm at the Diag. In front of Hatcher Graduate Library. So, okay. So what kind of books can we read at this? What are some banned books? Bone!
So...
Why is Bone banned in some
places? If you go to the CBLDF website, cbldf.org, they have a page on there of 22 banned and challenged comics, which are either comics that were actually pulled from shelves or that people made requests to not be in a library or not to be in a school, and the reasons that were given, and some of them you look at and you're like, yeah, I can see where somebody might not want to have their child exposed to that sort of thing.
Sure, yeah, like Charles Burns' Black Hole, I'm not going to give to a 6-year-old,
right? Necronomicon, Neonomicon, Yeah, Neonomicon by Alan Moore and Jason Burroughs, which should not be read by children. I will say that. I would not give that to a child to read. I would not give that to many adults to read. But anyway, then there's stuff like Bone, and you and I are fans of Bone, and and I gave that to my nephew when he was 6 years old to read, sort of thing, and somebody objected to scenes of smoking in that.
Oh.
One of the Bone cousins was in the cow costume and smoking a cigar, and the parent who objected to this was basically saying, you know, I don't think that depictions of smoking should, and the drinking too. There's some amount of villagers hanging out in the bar,
I guess,
drinking beer, and that this should not be in a comic for children, which is certainly an attitude that one might want to take. But I don't. But you know, children see people smoking and drinking. Right?
Yeah, that's just it, man. I mean, it's like that's so, because it's so not important to the story.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's not central to the conflict with the rat creatures and with everybody's backstories that, like, oh, Andy smokes, right? That's right. Like central. And it's such an incidental thing. That's weird.
So
I've lived in dry counties before, and I've seen, you know, how some people can react very viscerally to things like that. So
it's an interesting list to go through and read all the different reasons why people object to certain things in comics, and it really is such a wide spectrum. It's going to be from the depiction of cultural minorities, or it can be stuff that happened in the past that we're trying to revise this out of our past, and we don't want our children to be learning about this in school. Or it's sex and drugs and rock and roll, or nudity, or any wide variety of things, and they're usually devoid of the context. You know, the for people complaining about.
Well, I want to know the complaint on Mouse. Do you know that?
Well,
is it because it's cartoon characters doing participating in World War II history?
Basically, so let me read it here from. Let's say Mouse. One story is set in the novels. Each race is depicted as a different animal. Jews are drawn as mice, Germans as cats, Poles as pigs, So they were depicted as being anti-ethnic and unsuitable for younger readers.
Anti-ethnic? How?
It's not going into detail.
Okay,
not going into much detail here. But it's often. that could very well be.
Could be.
I would not say this is suitable for a 8-year-old.
But
I think that an intelligent 14-year-old could probably process Miles.
Didn't Spiegelman win the Pulitzer for that book?
He did. He won the Pulitzer, won a special Pulitzer Prize for Miles.
Wow. Okay.
And that's one of the when they were defending this against the challenge. They're like, look, it won a Pulitzer. This is a serious work of literature here that we're talking about.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So again, like, you have to wonder, are they getting any context in their making these judgments? Because when you think about it, like, it won the Pulitzer. There is a huge, giant 500-pound bag of evidence that this book is culturally important.
Right. Yes. Right.
Right. This isn't about, like, you know, my silly little comic about robot girls having, like, some kind of racial injustices. Right.
So this is the point where dialogue and education can come into the play, because mm-hmm. you know, somebody is having a surface reaction to something that they see in a comic, and so you can talk about and the particular person who's making the complaint may not be open to your arguments in your dialogue, but the greater community. Probably will be.
You're reminding me. I this is something when we talk about internet fights, and a case that I like to make, and I've seen other people say similar words to this effect, is that when there's an internet fight, in my experience, people don't remember exactly what was said. They only remember who really lost their cool.
Right. Yeah.
You know, who descended to name calling and meanness. Right.
Right. Right.
And so. The trick is, I think, like you're saying, is like, don't be the kid who's like, shut up, dad, you don't get it. but to say, like, okay, you may be acting a little irrational. I'm going to try to get through to you. And even if I don't get through to you, there may be somebody else listening who I get through to.
Right, right.
That's an important intangible that we shouldn't lose sight of when we're doing this kind of thing, right?
So, right, right. So we got off track. We were talking about content labeling, and we got way off track. Can we circle back to that?
We can.
Because I was doing research on this yesterday. So in the 80s, in the late 80s, DC Comics came up with a plan for content labeling for their comics. And at the time, they had started not putting the comics code on certain select comics. Alan Moore's Swamp Thing was one of the ones that.
And they put for mature readers across
for mature
the top.
Readers or suggested for mature readers.
Yes,
or
yeah.
something
that sounds right.
That and before that they had like sophisticated suspense and
yep, I remember that
thing,
too.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And so, so there's basically at the time there were basically three sorts of things that DC was publishing. They were publishing stuff with the Comics Code seal on it. They were publishing a few titles without the Comics Code seal on them, mainly because they were direct. They're going only through the direct market, mm-hmm. and so they didn't have to have the seal on it to get newsstand distribution. So they didn't bother submitting them to the Comics Code Authority at the time.
Okay.
It was New Teen Titans and when they went
Baxter paper.
Yeah, that's right, and Legion of Superheroes and the Outsiders and Infinity Inc. I think were the
yes,
four,
I remember
four
that.
Titles.
Yeah,
three of which were then a year later were being published for newsstand sales and then got submitted to the Comics Code Authority after.
Oh, I did not know that. I was wondering why like Teen Titans came out again later. I remember when I was a kid and I was like, wait a minute, this came out like last year. Why am I reading this again?
They were doing
it's on
this,
newsprint or
they
something.
They were doing this hardcover paperback release format where it would be released in this upscale format only at the direct sales shops.
Oh.
And then a year later, they would reprint the stories in the newsstand, a comic.
I learned something.
And then there were a handful of titles like Swamp Thing and The Shadow and a couple others, perhaps. Watchmen, mm-hmm. The Dark Knight Returns, that had a suggested for mature readers thing on it. And DC had decided that they were going to go to a internal in-house content labeling system that would be either it was universal or
mature
or
adult
only. Mm-hmm. So everything would have to fall into one of those three categories. And the complaint that Alan Moore and Frank Miller and
Marv
Wolfman and Howard Chaykin, they wrote a letter. I forget if it was a public letter or something that was published in the Comics Buyer's Guide. Mm-hmm. And I might be getting the timeline of everything exactly messed up. So comics historians, please forgive me on this. That objected to the fact that the creators were not consulted in this. And in Marv Wolfman's case, he was an editor at the time, and he was not consulted as an editor.
Wow.
And so he was kind of upset about that as well. And they said that they would not be doing new work for DC once their current contracts on stuff ran out. So they were rather publicly, and Marv Wolfman was fired from his editorial position because of this. I was reading, there's an interview with Dick Giordano, which I think was in the issue after the Alan Moore interview or the issue before. It was around that same time. The Comics Buyer's Guide and the Comics Journal at the time were covering this rather heavily because there was no comics internet in the day.
No, I mean, there was like CompuServe where you could like get on bulletin boards, but it wasn't widely used.
Right,
yet.
Right. Yeah. So the news broke much slower. And you could do a 5-page interview with Dick Giordano about it, you know, and not a 1-page thing on Newsarama sort of deal on that.
Right.
So there was a falderall about this content labeling about stuff and
the vibe I got from what I read was that it had a lot to do with internal standards being imposed upon the authors,
right? Without their input on what those standards
would be.
And if you read DC's version of the events versus the creator's version of the events, as all things are. They have two different concerns, and they're largely agreeing on 90% of the things, and they're disagreeing about the 10%.
And motivation. We're talking about context,
right.
Too, because like a lot of the question came out of the fact that was this as simple as what's the fellow who was running Diamond at the time, Diamond Distribution, which
right.
at the time was like the number one way to get comics, and still is a very, very important way to get like monthly comics, right. Basically saying like, hey, you guys should make your comics a little bit more decent. And then apparently, like,
there was letters from prominent
Comic store owners.
Comic store owners who were complaining about, you know, about the general state of comics, and how they're not like we remembered them when we were kids.
Well, and I'll buy the argument that, like, dude, you guys are putting me in a weird pickle because I run this comic store and suddenly I got these books that I can't give to kids.
Right. I can't possibly read this. I can't possibly read all these comics that are coming out all the time.
That's right.
Right? This is the argument that you were making, that you were...
No, that's right. I mean, and I think that's actually a valid argument. I can't read everything, so how am I supposed to know?
Right.
Right.
And DC claimed that they were planning this before the letters were published, and the creators were claiming that it was a reaction to the letters that were published.
Sure.
So what ended up happening is DC ended up not imposing this content rating system. They just went back to what they've been doing before, which was slapping mature readers on some titles and other titles not having the comics code and all that. Flash forward to today, the comics code is dead. Yes. It died sometime between 2009 and officially in 2011 is what it.
Wow, that recently. I thought it was longer ago.
It was that was when the last publisher, Archie, stopped using the comics code. It was in 2011.
It's redundant. It's moot, right?
But its death began when Marvel decided that they were not going to submit their stuff to the comics code, and they were going to impose what? Their own in-house rating system. And then DC followed suit, and other publishers followed suit. And it really, I think, came from the manga publishers.
Yep.
A lot of them came from the bookstore world, Viz and Tokyo Pop and all of them. And they were slapping ratings on their comics, whether it was, you know, all ages T for teen,
T for everyone. Basically, like, borrowing a lot from, like, the video game rating systems, right?
Yep. Yep. And so it's sort of become this non-issue now that we're just sort of accepting that there will be ratings that all of the media that we consume, television, movies, video games, comic books, everything except for books, everything except for novels, right?
Wow.
Are going to have this content rating thing.
The following program is intended for mature audiences. Viewer discretion is advised.
And then they list all the wonderful stuff that you, if this has got nudity. It's got adult language. I'm watching this. It sounds great.
You know, it's obvious we got to have this discussion again to go into this in more detail, because another, you're bringing up the fact that banning something could also potentially titillate
the Streisand effect, right?
Yes, the Streisand effect, right?
Which was when Barbara Streisand objected to the fact that there was a photograph of one of her houses that was on some website. It was an aerial photograph of thing, and she didn't want it there. And her act of complaining about it and the publicity involved in the complaining meant that millions of people went to see this photograph.
Well, like the right to be forgotten thing with that fella. I forget, was he in Russia? No. Right. He was someplace not in North America, and he wanted, because he was like the whole EU thing with the whole right to be forgotten law. And he said, like, there was a bankruptcy in my past that I don't want people to have access to. And by pointing at that and saying, I don't want people to know about this thing, suddenly that's the only thing. I think it was John Oliver said, like, now that's the only thing we know about this guy.
Right. So the act of saying, hey, this should not be consumed by people, it's going to cause people to go look at it, right?
Yeah.
There are a lot of authors who are hoping that their books get challenged, because that's going to bring this publicity to their work, and it's going to sell more copies.
That's something I've been kind of secretly hoping in the back of my head is, you know, we got this book, the Warren Commission report that came out, and like some of the discussions I've had with friends, like, are you worried about conspiracy theorists? And that's kind of coming at you. I'm like, I kind of hope they do.
I hope they all buy it to rail against it.
Yeah, I just want one guy. I want like Bill O'Reilly to go like, this is trash, and then I can go, yay, we made a lot of money.
the unintended effects of rating systems and censorship and banning books is that it doesn't necessarily do what you want it to do.
Yeah. Like, well, we only have so much control over that, right?
That's right.
So it is. I think the big takeaway for me is that it is upon us. As I'm going to be really corny, I'm going to say, like, as Americans, you know, to get involved in. I'm going to put on my Uncle Sam from the Freedom Fighters hat. But it's kind of upon us to get involved in these kind of discussions. It's upon us to get involved with our local constituencies and not just scream to the mayor, like, hey, I don't like this thing. You know, not necessarily like observe the chain of command, but. There are people who you can talk to before you make a big explosive fuss about it, right? There are reasonable people who are willing to listen to you.
Right.
So, yeah, I know that I don't know. Again, I'm not speaking for ADL, but I know that they do have their own policy about challenged books, and they put people on it to review the challenge and discuss it with people. And they've got a system in place for that. So you have avenues outside of screaming bloody murder about it. And on the other side, if you are a person who loves comics, whether you make comics, whether you, you know, collect comics, or whether you're a librarian about comics, it's also upon you to defend, you know, the works that get challenged.
And sometimes it's hard to defend those things.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, yeah. Like, when we were talking about, like, you know, like, I don't have any issues of Cherry in my house, and I would never. You know, it's not something I'm even remotely interested in. But First Amendment, dude, we get... That guy gets to make those comics, even if I don't like them, you know? And if I don't like them, I get to make comics that propose an alternate point of view.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, why do you defend Playboy magazine or whatever? It's like, so we don't have to defend Newsweek.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. Right. That's a terrific way of putting it.
So sometimes we're placed in the uncomfortable position of defending stuff we don't like.
Yes.
And so
we don't have to be friends to be allies, right?
Right, right.
So I think that's another thing that we forget sometimes. We think that we got to be buds to all be on the same team. No. I mean, it like the thing I think about the division in my mind is like I don't have to like you very much to believe that you are a fellow, you know, cartoonist advocate.
Right.
And if you are a cartoonist advocate, I will forgive a lot.
Yeah.
So, all right.
So we could go on and on and on.
We could, but we're already over time.
We have barely scratched the surface of this, folks. So,
if you are listening or watching and you think this was great, I would love more of this, let us know. And a way to let us know is you can follow Dave Carter on Twitter, Dave Reads Comics.
Yes,
right?
Dave Reads Comics.
And you can @tweet him. I'm Jersey on Twitter. You can @tweet me. You can comment on the YouTube video or on the Google Plus event page. You know, let us know. We would love to do more of this. We would love to have you guys part of that discussion. Because yeah, well, there's I basically got through a third of my notes.
We've barely scratched the surface of this entire topic. So
yeah.
maybe someday we can pick up where we've left off.
We will. Right. And we'll bring in more voices on this. I'd love to get like Larry Marder in here from the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund to talk more about it. So action items. Go to the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, CBDLF.
CBLDF.org.
Nonprofit.
Yes, you can donate to them and write it off on your taxes, probably. Talk to your accountant.
Yeah, I think they're a 501(c).
Yeah, they are.
And then also, if you're in the Ann Arbor area, go to the read-in tomorrow from noon to 1 in front of Hatcher Graduate Library. And
It's going to be a gorgeous day tomorrow.
Yeah, it is.
Sunshine, 75 degrees.
Perfect day for it.
It is. It's a great day to read comics in public.
And then you can go to Pinball Pete's afterwards, or you can go to the Duderstadt and play some video games there. When you encounter these discussions happening and people saying, why are people reading this trash, it's upon you to get involved in a thoughtful and empathic way. Try to understand where they're coming from. Try to patiently explain. Even if they don't get it, somebody else might. So that's how we make comics a more widely read medium. So thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Jersey. This was fun.
I did have fun. I thought this was going to be all grim, but it was actually a pretty fun discussion. So, all right. This show will be archived at comicsaregreat.com/CAG105. If you enjoy the show, you can thank the show by giving it a thumbs up on YouTube if you're watching the video. If you're listening to it on your podcatcher, you know, give it a review on iTunes. Just a star review. You don't have to write a review, but you could write a review. Just, you know, however many stars you think the show deserves, that helps more people find the show. And thank you to Matt DeBay and Al in the control room for, stringing this thing together over and over and over again. I know I'm prematurely aging you, Matt, and I apologize. And thanks, Dave Carter of Dave Reads Comics on Twitter. What other site should we point to?
That's enough. You can find
me
there.
All right. Twitter's where you're most active. All right. So until next time, everybody, thanks for downloading, watching, and listening. I've been Jersey Drozd of ComicsAreGreat.com and Jersey on Twitter. Okay, bye.